Welcome to episode 472 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Top Cow Thursday episode. I'm going to be talking in depth about three Top Cow books that came out this Wednesday, August 22nd. So forewarned is forearmed. There will be lots of spoilers in this episode. I normally don't talk about books in such a spoiler-heavy way so soon after they've come out. But I'm just not sure when I'll have time to talk about these books again. And they're all so fresh in my mind from reading them this last weekend when I got my preview copies. And they're all so good. I just wanted to go ahead and I just honestly couldn't wait any longer to talk about them. So I hope you guys don't mind too much. So I'm going to start by talking about Aphrodite 5, number 2. It's from writer Brian Edward Hill, and we've got art from Jeff Spokes. I think when I tweeted about it originally, my autocorrect on my phone corrected it to Spikes, but it is Spokes, S-P-O-K-E-S. And this is basically kind of a tech noir story, I think is how I described it. We've got Aphrodite 5. She is not human. She's much more than human. She's an artificial being, I guess you would say. And the antagonists in the issue seem to worship perhaps an artificial intelligence, some kind of artificial being as well. Basilisk, as he's called. And we got that word in the first issue, but we weren't 100% what that meant. And in this issue, we get a little more about Basilisk, and it turns out that he may have some ties to our main character. Well, no, there could be an argument made that Aphrodite 5 is the main character, but Martin Carver is certainly a key figure in the book as well. You know, a gay billionaire African, how would it go? A gay African-American billionaire entrepreneur philanthropist, perhaps. More money than he knows what to do with. He has talked about the fact that his father, before he died, along with a group of his colleagues, seven scientists all working together in secret, developing technology outside of international law. And one night they all had the same dream, and they believe it was a message sent back from a future sentient mechanical intelligence. And it basically taught them how to create AI, a mechanical god, if you will. And that's kind of all we know at this point. Although, I mean, we can speculate that perhaps Martin Carver is think of him as the John Connor, to make a Terminator reference. You know, he might be the one man capable of defeating Basilisk, and so for that reason, Basilisk wants him eliminated. But he's managed to hook up with Aphrodite 5, who was made to kill, and it's not that she's after some noble purpose by aligning herself with Carver. She's not denying her true nature at all. In fact, she says in the issue that she was built to be a hunter, built to be an assassin. And she doesn't want to stop hunting, but she wants to hunt the things that deserve it, so to speak. So we get our first glimpse of Basilisk in this issue right at the end, the last page, before it's to be continued in issue 3. And it's just a very tightly woven tale. It definitely has a distinct tone and feel. I think when I was talking about the first issue, I mentioned Michael Mann. I know that when I spoke to Brian Edward Hill about the series at San Diego Comic-Con, I mentioned that as well. And he kind of confirmed that. He's a huge Michael Mann fan. He thinks of LA as kind of a, you know, its own special magical place through that lens of those really slick movies. And I was talking on Twitter to one of the listeners today about that. He was asking about the art in the book, if I felt like it still kind of had that look and that tone. I said, for the most part, yes, it does. And when I got home, I was looking at the book again, going through it and trying to see. It's definitely, it's stylized as far as colors go, right? All the rendering, the figure work and everything is done extremely well by Jeff Spokes. I can't fault his storytelling, his transitions. I love the way he lays panels out on the page, a lot of insets. And I like the way he kind of moves the reader's eyes around the page. And I love the angles. I think that's probably the strongest part of his art, where he chooses to put the camera, so to speak, so that you get different angles and different looks at people, whether it's looking up at them from beneath or whether they're looking over their shoulder at you, you know, whatever it might be. He definitely does a lot of close-ups and a lot of angled shots, and so it helps to set the mood and give it that kind of film noir feel, right? But as I mentioned, where it is stylized is the color. It's very much a muted palette, and on top of that, it almost seems like we're looking at everything through a filter at times. And I was going through it and I was trying to see, is it like a greenish filter? Is it blue? Is it red? It almost seems to change colors at times. But if I look at it objectively, because even the reds aren't like super bright, super vibrant, if there's any kind of filter on it, I think it's like a grayish filter. That's what it is. We're looking at everything through this sort of gray filter, which helps to give it a gritty feel, but also the feel of something noirish, right? Like I hate to keep going back to the comparison, but definitely like a Michael Mann movie. So it definitely reads like a late 80s, early 90s action movie. Think RoboCop, think Bad Boys, something like that. A lot of great physical action. This is set in the Top Cow artifact universe, but it doesn't feel quite as supernatural or science fiction as some of the other titles that have been grounded in that universe. This feels much more real, much more realistic. And I like that. I like that. I think it suits the story that Brian's trying to tell very, very well. And again, there are some obvious nods to things like RoboCop, let's say. Specifically, there's a line where Aphrodite 5 says, "Drop your weapon or there will be trouble." So anybody who's seen RoboCop remembers that that line. It's not exactly the same in RoboCop. It's, "Come with me or there will be trouble." There's that pause, right? And he'll make sure to put that in. So I really recommend this book. It's very compelling, and I can't wait to see how much it ties into the greater artifact universe and the origins of Aphrodite, really. And the thing that strikes me the most as I was thinking about what I wanted to talk about when it came time to speak about the title, it's like, okay, with Think Tank, which I think initially the imprint that Top Cow called it was Minotaur, but now it's kind of just part of their regular publishing line, but it is its own separate universe, right? I think Matt Hawkins calls it the Edenverse, after Eden, Wyoming, which is the town in Postal, where criminals go for a second chance. And then he also tied in his Tithe series, or Samaritan Veritas, is what they called it. But when I think back to that first few volumes, perhaps, of Think Tank, it was such a cerebral book, right? So grounded in hard science, but with these fantastical ideas that you thought of as science fiction. And then you'd go to the back of the book and you'd read the science classes and you'd see the links and you'd go and look at the research Matt Hawkins did and find out that, yeah, these invisibility cloaks seem like science fiction, but in fact, the army has them right now. And that was really cool to see that, right? And that book always kind of stayed, I don't want to say high concept, but it stayed on that cutting edge of technology, right? Like it was very much kind of a thinking man's book, very much for like a lot of people that enjoyed it were really into science and technology and kind of tech nerds and loved the fact that Matt put all this research in it and you could go and look for yourself. And it was just really cool, right? Very realistic. And then on the other side, you had like the regular Top Cow Artifact universe where things like the Witchblade and Darkness, clearly something mystical about them, clearly something magical, you know, different dimensions and time travel and all that kind of stuff. And it was much more not just superhero, but supernatural, right? So they seemed very different. And then as time has gone on, I think Think Tank came down a little bit. It wasn't quite on the edge of cutting edge technology quite as much as it started out as, because I think Matt ultimately was giving more service to the characters, which I was totally fine with. I thought that was great that the characters in there had, you know, showed growth emotionally, became more of an emotional book, which was, again, fine. I loved it. It's still one of my favorite titles. And I think Matt just tweeted out today or yesterday about rumors of it, possible volume 6. So that would be awesome. But anyway, I mentioned that to say that, you know, Brian Edward Hill started out writing Postal with Matt Hawkins. And then, cause Matt came up with the concept originally, and then Matt turned over the writing duties, like full time to Brian, felt that Brian had a better voice for it, having a background in psychology and such, and better at dialogue than Matt is. And the book was fantastic. We're going to do a spotlight on it one of these days. I need to do a reread of it, honestly, before we do that. But my point is Brian was in that universe, right? In that universe, telling very grounded tales, telling very realistic stories. And it was great. It fit in the Edenverse perfectly. Now what you have, both in Cyberforce, which Brian's helping to write, and also in Aphrodite 5, and in Aphrodite 5 even more so than Cyberforce, because in Cyberforce you still have some of those fantastical science fiction ideas. It's much more of a still has kind of some roots in superheroes, right? But with Aphrodite 5, it reminds me so much from a realism standpoint, from a character-driven story standpoint of Brian's work in Postal. I mean, the stories are completely different. Characters are completely different. But from there's something about it that I can't help but be reminded of Brian's incredible run on Postal when I read this Aphrodite 5 book, just because he's got the voices of the characters down so well. And so what's interesting is that Edenverse to me is a world that's much more close to like our world, right? Without, you know, a bunch of like superpowers or that kind of stuff, right? Things are more grounded in reality. And now you're taking that sense, that storytelling sensibility, and you're bringing it over to the artifact side of the universe. And I think that's amazing. I think it's taking the best sensibility, the best storytelling tone of that Edenverse and what makes it really special, and bringing that over to the artifact universe to tell this story. I think it's pitch perfect. I think that this book is really, really good. And as Brian is fleshing out kind of the early days here of Aphrodite 5, and she's kind of finding who she is before she, you know, evolves into Aphrodite 6 and 7 and, you know, eventually 9. There's a lot here. There's a lot here to explore. And I know Brian's fascinated by the idea of like what makes us human and transhumanism and how far can you go and still be human. And, you know, here we have Aphrodite 5, who's not human at all, but is still in a way searching for her humanity, searching for a purpose, kind of like we all do in life, right? And she feels like, well, I have a purpose. I was built for a purpose. I was built to kill, but I don't want to just be a weapon of destruction. I don't want to be just some like a weapon that's somebody points and shoots, right? She wants what she does to matter more than that. And as she said in her own words, she wants to hunt those that deserve to be hunted. So again, I think there are some really high concepts here, but you don't have to want to think about those concepts. If you just want to read a really great story that has its own unique tone and feel, then you can just pick up the book and read it for, you know, what it is on the surface, which is a really slick look at Aphrodite 5's early days. It's really, really well done. So kudos to Brian and Jeff both on an incredible start. The first two issues have been really, really good. All right, the next book I'm going to talk about that came out from Top Cow today is Witchblade number 7, and it's from writer Caitlin Kittredge. We've got Roberta Ingranata as the artist, and Brian Valenza on colors with Troy Pateri doing the letters. What I really like about this is, well, first we get a bit of a flashback, and it's not completely clear how that's going to tie in to the story going forward. It's kind of just out there on its own for now. So I'm looking forward to seeing where that goes. But then we jump to the present day. We see Alex wielding the Witchblade, and we find out through the course of the story that it's been quite a few months since the end of the first volume. So I do like that. I like that she's had time to kind of learn what the Witchblade is. Kind of, you know, we don't have to watch her come to terms with the Witchblade and what it is. At least no more than we did see her do that in the first volume, because, you know, 3 months have gone by, and we're assuming in that time that she's accepted the fact that she's bonded to this Witchblade, and she's using it to the best of her abilities to fight the war of whatever this evil thing is from this otherworldly thing that we met in the first issue that seems to want to destroy her. So one thing we didn't get was a resolution, because we did see that her boyfriend, I can't remember what his name is right now, but you know, the guy that supposedly died 6 years before, and then all of a sudden he's back and he just showed up, and that's kind of the cliffhanger that the first volume ended on, and we don't have answers for that. It's, you know, I almost was hoping, okay, so the next volume is just going to open up with that's like the next beat, right? Like a few seconds after that first one ends, when Johnny shows up, that's his name. And we'd get some answers, but we don't. It's 3 months down the line, and Alex is in a bit of a different place. And we do see Johnny show up in the issue. And what we also find out is that he knows about the Witchblade. He maybe knows more about the Witchblade than Alex does. So what does that mean? And how does Johnny know it? And how did he come back from the dead? These are all questions that I imagine are going to be answered in this second volume. So I really like, as I said, that the story skips forward, because then we don't have to read about that awkward phase where Alex finally comes to accept the Witchblade. And you know, she kind of did that in the first, at the end of the first volume. But again, we, you know, there would have been some vacillation to, you know, if you want to be realistic about it, and her still having doubts or anything, everything like that. So the fact that we skipped over that, I did like that. The tone still feels the same. It's still, this book still feels very grounded with strong female characters. And there's not as much of the supporting cast in this particular issue. Like I said, we see Johnny, and that's about it. Maj, I guess. Maj, M-A-J. We see him as well. He's still good friends with Alex as well, kind of like his her right-hand man, so to speak. As far as the assassin that's out to kill Alex, not sure yet. Johnny seemed to recognize her, I think, in a way. So again, this, although this volume skipped forward 3 months, it, as far as like action wise, pacing wise, it did pick up like right where the first volume left off. A lot of action, fast paced, punching and kicking and asking questions later, is kind of the feel of it, which, I'm enjoying. It's a bit of non-linear storytelling, right? Like, we just had this big jump. We know we're going to need some answers to some of these questions, which is going to inherently require flashback for Johnny to explain how he survived, when Alex thought he was dead all this time, when we, you know, find out the connection between Johnny and the Witchblade and all that kind of stuff. So there's still a lot of stories to be told, a lot of things to explore, and I really like this new bearer of the Witchblade. She reminds me of Sarah Pazzini as far as strength of character goes, but she's wildly different. She seems almost damaged in a way, and so that makes her a little bit more human and more relatable and more real, that she's not some kind of, you know, stylized, super good looking, you know, character that you can root for and see as like this iconic hero. You know that Alex has been through some stuff, and it's scarred her. And again, that just makes her feel more realistic, in a way. So, and we still haven't totally seen her like completely armored up in the Witchblade outfit yet, so still looking forward to that. But I feel like in this title, Caitlin Kittredge is really focused on telling great stories with these characters, and it just so happens that one of the characters is the bearer of the Witchblade, but it's not the story of the Witchblade. You know what I'm saying? Like, I almost feel at this point, the fact that she has the Witchblade is kind of a secondary concern. And I know for a lot of longtime fans of the Witchblade, that's probably the issue they have with it, right? Like, they, if you're a fan of the original Witchblade, I mean, this is not it. This is wildly different. And, you know, the fact that we don't see her really like armor up with the Witchblade every issue and go fight the villain of the week, yeah, it might bother some people. Again, the Witchblade, at least to this point of the story, is taking a little bit of a backseat while we really get to know these characters. I personally enjoy that. I think, you know, you take an interesting story on its own, and then you add the Witchblade into it, and you make a more interesting story. But again, so that might not be what some people are looking for. Some people, you know, say, the title's called Witchblade. I want to see Witchblade, right? And that we haven't gotten a lot of that yet. We got some of that, especially in issues 5 and 6 of volume 1. And I imagine we'll get more as time goes on and we start to have a better understanding of who Alex is and who the supporting cast is. So I totally get it. You know, this book's not for everybody, but as I said, I'm really enjoying it. I'm enjoying the strong characterization and the fact that Alex is a pretty formidable and interesting character, in spite of the fact that she has the Witchblade. You add the Witchblade, and that's like icing on the cake. So, really, really great job from Caitlin Kittredge. As far as the art goes, by Roberta Ingranata, I can't really imagine anyone else drawing this book. I think she has the characters down very well. She has New York down very well. This is very much a kind of a street level, gritty looking title, which suits the story that Kittredge is telling. The flashback scene in the beginning of the book that I mentioned has a very different tone. It's kind of colored differently. So that really helps to kind of set the mood right off the bat that it's back in the past. So kudos to Brian Valenza for doing that. And the whole book is colored really, really well. It's, for the most part, a lot of blues and grays, which, you know, suits kind of the gritty story that's being told, especially set in New York City. We do get some bright greens when Sarah's using the Witchblade power. And there are some, you know, few places, you know, some blood and things like that, which kind of jump off the page. But all in all, it's an incredibly well-done book. I think Roberta Ingranata has gotten stronger since the first volume. I think her sense of storytelling and her transitions from panel to panel are even stronger in this issue than they were. Like if I were to go back and look at the first issue, I'm sure I'd see marked improvement. And I imagine she'll keep improving from that perspective. So again, kudos. And I do recommend picking up Witchblade Volume 7. And if you haven't read Volume 1, definitely pick that up too. You can find the trade and get caught up. All right, the last book that I'm going to mention now, this was kickstarted. So I don't think, I'm not sure on this, but I don't think this graphic novel was available in stores today. It was released today on Comixology, though. And it's Stairway from Matt Hawkins with art by Rafael Ionco. And I could be wrong about that. It might have been a hard copy released today by Top Cow as well. But it's basically, you know how I was talking about Think Tank before with concepts, high science concepts that were completely factual. This is the same kind of thing, right? It's been postulated and tested and proven to be true that you can store data in DNA, like binary data, right? Like, so all data that's stored in the world is all in a binary code. So ones and zeros. And based on the order and numbers of the ones and zeros, it eventually gets translated into data that we humans can read, right? Whether that be some kind of language, some kind of programming language, or an English language, or sometimes it could be a mathematical language, could be numbers, what have you. So there are scientists that have proven this to be true, to be able to take the four basic building blocks of DNA, and based on the order of them, like have data stored, right? That could then be extracted and translated into some kind of language, and that's how your data would be stored, right? Because when you look at the human genome, the human, you know, strands of DNA, there's so much of it that we don't know what it does, right? Like kind of like junk, quote unquote, junk DNA. We just don't know what it's there for. So Matt Hawkins takes that idea and says, okay, what if that junk DNA that we don't really know what it's for, what if that is actually data? What if that's actually data that's been stored in human DNA down through the centuries, right? Maybe it was put there by quote unquote God way back when, and it's just he's been waiting all this time, or she, or you know, however you identify God, whatever pronoun you want to use. So God put that there so that we eventually would evolve to the point where we could discover it, and we could take that DNA and decode it, and it would be like the secrets of the universe, right? Or maybe it was put there by aliens or whoever brought us here to Earth and seeded the planet. You know, if you want to look at what was the movie with Darius Sinise and Connie Nielsen and Tim Robbins, Mission to Mars, I think it was, where it's talking about Martians, you know, seeded the Earth way back when. Anyway, that's kind of the concept that Matt draws on from here. And a graduate student, brilliant graduate student, discovers this data hidden in DNA and there's this trillionaire philanthropist who kind of makes it his life's work, becomes completely obsessed with it, with finding all the pieces, right? So there's like 666. I know, right? There's a lot of symbolism in this book, and there's the whole argument on, you know, science and technology versus religion and belief and faith. And I mean, there's a lot of concepts here, and I'm not gonna dig deep into it because I'd be here for another hour or so, because that's how many high concepts there are. So I'm just gonna like real briefly go over it, just a few of my thoughts. And so 600 of the pieces are very easy to find, right? Like almost anybody you know, go and find in the world, you take a sample of their DNA and they've got one of these pieces. But the other 66 are very rare and they're hard to find. So this trillionaire philanthropist, again, he becomes obsessed, and you know, he's fighting with the governments of the world to try to get this done, and he's lying and cheating and stealing because he believes that the ends justify the means. He's like kidnapping people, and because he is completely obsessed and completely convinced that this is something that needs to be done for the human race to survive. Because the Earth, it's not doing too well. There's been a nuclear war between India and Pakistan, overpopulation, pollution. You know, a lot of the cities of the world that were on the coast are underwater, like LA, because of all the fallout from the nuclear war, and famine is especially an issue, just having enough food to feed everybody. And so this guy, he believes that what he needs to do, Gregory Hopkins is his name, is he needs to find all the pieces no matter what it takes, because each of these pieces of data, when input into like a 3D printer, print these cubes that then join another larger cube, and when he puts all 666 together, something's going to happen, right? He's not sure what, but as he gets closer and closer to completing it, him as well as his right-hand man, Vincent Martin, start having visions, and they believe that this will save humanity. And the graduate student that originally found all this, Dr. Alicia Vander, who she found it in her own DNA, and she had one of the rare ones. She's eventually trusted by Gregory Hopkins to know the secret of what all these pieces actually do. And so she's brought in, but she's like our POV character, and she's much more emotional. Hopkins sees this as like his life's work, and he's going to go down as this great, powerful man in history who saved the human race. So when you look at it from that perspective, it's okay to, you know, break some eggs. You got to make an omelet. Alicia Vander is much more practical, I guess you'd say. And when it comes down to a choice of a single life of somebody she cares about greatly and changing the whole world, she's going to follow her heart, because the other is the unknown, and she's not willing to take that risk. So I'm not going to spoil how it ends and what exactly happens, but I will say that the concept of what the machine can do is also an interesting one. It has a lot to do with like regret, and would you go back and change things if you could? And if you did get a chance to turn back the clock, could you really stop all the bad stuff from happening all over again? Right? I mean, fundamentally, you're the same person. It's just now you have the knowledge, the foreknowledge of, okay, if I made this choice, like, I turned right at that stop sign, and that's when I got in the car accident. Maybe this time I'll go straight, right? But then when you do that, now all of a sudden your foreknowledge isn't as complete as it was before, because now you've changed something, right? And so, like, how much can you change and still have knowledge? And eventually you change enough things, then the future is completely different, which I suppose is the point, but now you're second guessing yourself. You know, there's a lot to unpack there, right? Like, there's a lot to unpack. So should you turn back the clock if you have the opportunity to go back and right some wrongs and fix some regrets you have? And what are the consequences of changing things? And at what point do you get yourself completely kind of wrapped around the axle, so to speak, because you're like, oh, well, I did this and I did this and I did this last time, and now I've changed those three things, and now I'm being faced with this new dilemma, which I never was faced with last time. And how do I know if I make the wrong choice here, it won't eventually put me back on the bad path? Like, right? I mean, you can become frozen, right? There's people that are like that in our own lives today, right? That have the hardest time making a decision because they're so scared of making the wrong choice. They just choose not to make any decision at all. They choose not to even leave their house, some of them. It's no way to live, right? You can't live in constant fear of making a mistake. I mean, none of us are perfect. So again, there's so many high concepts here: God, faith, fate, predestination, the needs of the many as opposed to the needs of the few, you know, utilitarianism. It's an incredible, thought-provoking story with amazing visuals by Raphael Ionco. I mean, this guy is just a superstar in the making. His art is so detailed, so emotional. I mean, we go from like super detailed pencil line work to nuclear explosions that are painted, and probably digitally painted, but still, I mean, just absolutely incredible. And then some pages we're seeing like these incredible, like, almost like northern lights in the background with ancient ancestors in the foreground. So you're mixing that the color work and the digital painting with incredible detailed line work. I mean, it's a gorgeous book to look at. And I mean, again, you can really lose yourself in thinking about a lot of the ideas. I found myself as I was reading it, like I'd read a few pages and then I would like look up from the book and I'd be like staring off into space, like thinking about some of these concepts. And I didn't feel necessarily like I was getting pulled out of the story. It's just that there's so much to unpack here and so much to think about that it's extremely thought-provoking. And one thing that Hawkins does is he does break it up into chapters. And so it does give you almost built-in like thinking breaks, if you want to put it that way, where you can stop and be like, okay, I finished that chapter. There was a lot there. Let me think about that for a while. And then I'm going to go back and read chapter two. I didn't really take that breaks that were that long because it was so compelling and I wanted to know what was going to happen. But it did take me a while to read it, longer than if I just, you know, sat there and devoured it, because I was stopping to ponder some of these concepts that Hawkins was presenting me with. And the other thing that Matt did in the narrative that I really liked was he started each chapter off with diary entries from Gregory Hopkins, which gave us more insight into, like right away, how arrogant and narcissistic and egocentric he is. But they're also really informative, and they help us to kind of understand the little jumps in time between the chapters and just give us a lot of information in a different way without having to put a bunch of like dialogue boxes on the page or exposition boxes on the page to explain things, or have one person just do an info dump, you know, telling the other person to get them caught up what's been going on. By doing these diary entries, we can kind of we can get direct information from what Hopkins is saying, and we can also read between the lines to some extent to kind of get an idea of what kind of person he is, get an idea in, or a view into his psyche and his thoughts, and also we can see what he's not saying, right? Like we get a sense of just how self-centered he is. And especially later on in the book when he has to go public with what the machine is, or the fact that a machine has been built from all these different DNA strands that have been found, when he goes public with that, and you know what he tells the world versus what he actually thinks or thinks he knows in private are two wildly different things. And so again, it gives us a lot of insight into just what kind of character he is. And the other thing that's cool is Matt kind of leaves it open-ended. He definitely leaves it at a place where he could go back and tell more stories in this world. So Matt told me about this book quite a few years ago. And I think when he first told me, I don't think it was exactly the same story. I think it has evolved a little bit. And Matt talks about that in some of the back matter about his collaboration with Rafael Ionco and changing the story a little bit and changing who narrates the story and things like that. You know, it's just the nature of working on, you know, projects and being able to make it better through collaboration and through, you know, different versions and drafts of the story. So, but the reason I mentioned that Matt told me about it quite a few years ago is because just like Eclipse, which was another title from Top Cow, which I heard about quite a few years before it actually came out, just like Eclipse, I was really anticipating this title. Like when Matt told me about it, I was like, man, that is a really, really cool idea. I can't wait to read it, right? So because I was anticipating it so much, whenever that happens, I invariably have high expectations just because I think it's such a great idea that I therefore automatically expect the story to be good, right? Like if you start with a great basic idea, it's got to be good. The story's got to be good, right? That's not always the case. You still got to execute. And my expectations were exceeded here. I think that this is an incredibly thought-provoking and interesting story that Matt has told, and Rafael Ionco too. His contribution can't be understated. So again, I'm not 100% sure if there were physical copies that went out to comic shops on the 22nd, but what I do know is it is available on Comixology. So I really, really encourage you, if you want a great read for a Saturday afternoon, a book that'll stay with you and give you something to think about long after you've finished it, and give you, like, I'm not even kidding. This is a, like, some of the concepts and the kind of dilemma or decision that the main characters are faced with, that are the decision they're presented with at the end of the book or toward the end of the book. Like, that's a concept that you could go out to dinner with your friends, you know, and have a nice dinner and a couple drinks and sit there and talk about it for hours. Like, that's how great of an idea and how thought-provoking and how much conversation you can generate from this idea, because it's one of those questions that doesn't necessarily have a right answer. I don't think there's a right, you know, right answer or one way of looking at it, because it's wrapped up so much in faith and belief and values, and a lot of those things are so, you know, personal and unique to each of us as individuals that you know, no two people are going to look at this book, they're going to read this story and think about the concepts the exact same way, right? Because we all, again, look at things a little bit differently. So there's so much value in this book. There's so much value in the story. This may be my favorite thing that Matt has ever written, honestly. I mean, I'm always going to hold Think Tank that's always going to have a special place in my heart. It was the first thing I ever read from Matt, and it started us, like, me discovering Think Tank started me down the road of you know, a really good friendship with Matt. And so, you know, that's always going to be really special to me. But yeah, this may be the best thing he's ever written, man. I mean, it's just so, so good. So it gets my highest possible recommendation. Again, really encourage you to go out, pick it up digitally from Comixology, and I'll look into if there's physical copies. In fact, let me look right now, because when I go and I look at the release list for today, it's on there as a graphic novel for $16.99. So yeah, and it has an ISBN number. So there definitely are physical copies out there that you can pick up. And let me see, I bet it's probably on Amazon as well. I'll let you know really quickly here. I really want you guys to be able to find this book and go and pick it up. Oh, you know what? It really helps. Yep. Yeah, it's on Comixology, or it's on Amazon as well. You can pick it up. Amazon Prime, $16.99. So there are physical copies out there. There are digital copies. Go and get it. It's amazing. Stairway from Matt Hawkins and Raph Ienko. Absolutely incredible. I can't wait till the next time I see Matt to just gush over how great this book is. And maybe may have to take him out to dinner and just talk about some of these ideas. I'm fascinated because Matt presented the questions, and you could think of it as, yeah, we also got the answers to these questions somewhat by the actions of the characters, like what the characters did. Just because the characters made a certain decision one way or the other doesn't mean that that's what Matt would do or what Matt thinks about it. It's just what he thought would make either the best story or what he thought that the character that he created would do in that situation, which may not necessarily be what Matt would do in that situation. So yeah, I can't wait till the next time I see him to get to talk to him about this book. So, all right. Well, as you can see, it was a really, really great week for Top Cow Books. Both the Stairway original graphic novel, Witchblade number 7 from Caitlin Kittredge and Roberta Ingranata, as well as Aphrodite 5 number 2 from Brian Edward Hill and Jeff Spokes. Recommend them all. They're all spectacular. And as you can see by the fact that I've been talking about them for almost an hour, I just didn't want to wait till the books had been out another week and talk about them next Top Cow Thursday, which is normally what I do, give you a whole week plus a day to read them. I wanted to talk about them right away. So obviously I said at the beginning, spoilers. If you've listened to it at the end now listen to the whole thing without having gone out and picked up any of these books, still go out and get them. You know, I try not to spoil everything. And if you already read them, and now you came back and listened to my thoughts, let me know what you thought. Let me know if you agree, disagree. Is there something you picked up on that I didn't? Always love to hear from other listeners. So thanks for joining me, everybody, as always. Don't forget to tell your friends about us, especially your comic reading friends. We always love to expand the family here at the Comic Source. Also, make sure you and they subscribe and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on iTunes. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you are at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow our convention coverage. I will be at Comic-Con Palm Springs this Saturday, which is, I think it's the 25th. Yep, the 25th of August. So if you're going to be there, let me know. Love to meet up with you, take a picture, hook you up with a Comic Source lanyard. So as I said, let me know. Hopefully I'll have a few creator interviews from the show to share with you after the following week. So look out for those. And once again, thanks for listening, everybody. And we'll talk to you next time.